Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2002 and goes out every Thursday morning at 11 a.m. here on BCFM 93.2. This week, Eco Villages, delayed from the week before last and last week. Finally, we get round to hearing from Roger Kelly. And also our weekly news and some disabled people's update this week too, with Jason Yannakopoulos. Plus the weekly What's On Guide and Song of the Week from Jeff Sparks. But we start this week with the Eco Village. How many people living together does it take to make a fully self-sustaining modern community, where there's enough specialists to deliver modern civilised needs and comforts such as health, education, water and power, transport and agriculture? And could such a community be entirely self-sustaining, not making everything itself but having surpluses they could use to trade and barter with the outside world for what they couldn't make themselves? Well, these are the questions that gripped two people with Bristol connections, both of whom found themselves over at the Centre for Alternative Technology at McUncliffe in Wales back in the early 1990s. One was the director of the Schumacher Society, Richard St. George, who sadly died last year. So, as a tribute to Richard and his work, here is his colleague, former director of Solon Southwest Housing Association and of the Centre for Alternative Technology itself, Roger Kelly. He describes their plan, which ended up being called Ecoville 2000, because it looked like they would only be able to build this state-of-the-art eco-village community over in France. So here's Roger talking about Richard and his Ecoville 2000 at the Somerset Big Green Gathering back in the summer of 2007. And apologies for the sound quality.
We spent 18 months doing the feasibility study. It was one hell of a lot of work, and I'll sort of go through a bit later on. And at the end of it, we had to put it all together. We had to have the whole thing. It was about 200 pages translated into French, with all the diagrams and everything else. And then we had to give a presentation of it to serried ranks of government officials in the sort of regional government offices. And that was pretty grueling. I mean, yeah, I had to do a lot of brushing up on French to be able to do that. And it went fine, actually. I mean, we didn't hear for a couple of weeks afterwards, but eventually the French government people came back to us and said, yeah, we think this is good, go ahead, and we'll work with you to actually realise this development. So we thought, fantastic, you know, all these years of work finally coming to fruition. So we trotted back down to the land, knocked on the farmhouse door, found the owner and said, everything's okay now, you know, we've been given the go-ahead. And he said, actually, I've decided not to sell the land after all. He said, I did offer it to my son originally to carry on the business, and he wasn't interested, but he's come back now and said, yeah, I think I'll take it on. So that was it. That was the end of the whole project. So, you know, we'd produced, I don't know, a couple of dozen copies of this feasibility study. It was obviously quite expensive to produce them, but because we had contacts with the French Eco Villages network as a whole, I just sent a message out saying, you know, if anybody else is interested in taking what we've done and making use of it to start up a development somewhere else, just we'll send you a copy of it. So I, you know, quite a few people did write in, and I kept sending out copies. And at some point, relatively recently, I discovered that I hadn't got a copy of the feasibility study left. So what I'm going to talk to you about now, about the actual feasibility study, is largely from memory. And I'm sorry, it would be nice to be able to sort of distribute copies of, or at least give you an electronic copy of the feasibility study. Unfortunately, it was done just at that time when it wasn't quite, you know, there weren't PDFs and couldn't upload stuff onto the web at that time, so not possible. I don't have a copy of it. I've been trying to find someone that's got a copy. In fact, a week ago I phoned up Gerard Morgan Grenville thinking he must have a copy of it, surely. And he looked around and said, no, he hasn't got a problem with it. And to be honest, I've got most of the text in English, and I've got most of the diagrams and pictures, so it would be possible to put it together again into a document. But I mean, these are all just in individual files, and not... I mean, the end product, of course, was desktop published. It wasn't just a simple Word document. So it would need a fair amount of work to put it back together. There's a third character I have to introduce to you as well, a guy called Richard St. George, that some of you may know, particularly in the Bristol area. He runs the Schumacher Society. He did work at CAT for a few years, long before I went there, but I got to know him during my time at CAT. And it was just one of those chance things. I don't quite know how it happened, but I was down in Bristol for some reason and stayed with him overnight, and we got talking about eco-villages. And it turned out that he'd been doing quite a lot of thinking about eco-villages, and particularly about the kind of minimum or optimum size for eco-villages, which is something that, you know, everybody's been discussing and churning over for years and decades and everything. So I had a really good evening talking to him about this, because I guess we must have been in the early stages of this French project, and this was obviously one of the key questions. How big is it going to be? What's the ultimate population going to be? I mean, you can't just sort of go and look it up and say, well, what's the best size for an eco-village? 50? 5,000? I don't know. But Richard St. George reckons that somewhere around 1,000 is probably about right. So about 300 households. Again, I haven't got all the sort of arguments of how he reached that figure, but there were a couple of things that stuck in my mind, particularly, and one which we carried through and tried to work out in our feasibility study, which was that it needed to be big enough so that teenagers had enough to keep themselves amused and occupied while they were there, and allowing for the fact that inevitably they were going to want to go away and travel the world or do something, whatever, because everybody does, that they would eventually want to come back to it, so that there was enough there for people, both while they were teenagers and when they'd got over that teenage thing and were young adults and felt that this was a good kind of place to settle. And it was also, to an extent, concerned with schooling as well. He felt very strongly that it needed to be able to support at least a primary level school. And this is where it gets very interesting, because as a result of that, I went away and did a bit of research into sort of general UK planning guidelines. So I thought, well, let's have a look and see what the planners say about the population you need to support a school. Would anybody like to guess what population they think is needed to support a primary school? You think it would be about 1,000?
More.
50,000. Yeah. It's the minimum population to support a primary school. I don't know how they work that out. So we beg to differ with them on that one. I mean, secondary schools are another thing. Of course, you can have small schools, and there are all sorts of pros and cons about it. You know, there are all sorts of arguments that when kids get to a certain age, it's good for them to mix with a lot of people who are from different social, racial, whatever backgrounds. I mean, I tend to agree with that, but not everybody does. I wouldn't have pushed the idea that an eco-village needed to have secondary schooling within its boundaries. I mean, of course, there are a lot of debates around this whole issue of how self-contained do you want an eco-village to be? How self-contained do people in it want to be? If it's an eco-village which is significantly different in all sorts of ways from the mainstream of rural society, in this case, because we're talking about rural areas, how much do you want to separate it off? How much interaction do you want to have with mainstream society outside this fence, running around 850 hectares of land? So those are the kind of issues we need to look at. But at the same time, you know, the French government people were pushing us to be able to prove that this 850 hectares of land with the fence around it was going to be economically sustainable in its own right, that it wasn't going to need subsidy from the state, it wasn't going to be a drain on the existing communities in the area. What they were interested in was bringing more money to rural areas. So we finally settled for this number of around about 1,000 people and started looking at the land and started planning it on the ground. There was one old farmhouse on the land. There was another newer house next to it where the existing owner lived. And as with all farms, there was a range of outbuildings all around, most of which were pretty derelict. Amazing architecture in that part of France, because it had been completely deforested in the 18th century. Before that, it had been dense forest up on top of this limestone plateau. During the 18th century, when the value of wool was going up and up and up, they completely deforested it and put it over to sheep grazing. And that's what it largely is, even now. But because sheep farming isn't very lucrative anymore, the number of sheep farmers is declining, and basically all the landscapes reverting back through its natural progression to forestry. So this 850 hectares of land was partly just fairly barren pasture land and partly regenerating woodland. In fact, the majority of it, I think, we classified as regenerating woodland. And it was actually a rather beautiful landscape, because where natural regeneration takes place, it's not in sort of huge blocks like commercial forestry. You tended to get a pattern of areas of trees with clearings in between. And then at one end of the site was this group of old farm buildings. So what seemed absolutely logical to us in terms of developing an eco-village was to create a village centre around those existing farm buildings, and then to have a series of communities of housing dotted around in these clearings in the woodland, and all of them linked together by a network of paths that were only for pedestrians, cyclists and people on horses. So the way the sort of master plan of the site worked was that there was an area on one edge of the site where motorised vehicles could be parked close to the village centre, so deliveries could be brought into the village centre, people could offload stuff there, and then all the routes from there out to the housing settlements were non-vehicular. So you had hand carts, you had bicycle carriers, rickshaws, horses and carts, whatever. And at the housing development, well, we thought there needed to be as much variety as possible. So there'd be smaller ones, bigger ones, there'd be some that were self-filled co-ops, there would be some that would be co-housing schemes, some that there might be people who sort of invested all their money together and actually got a contractor in to build their eco-houses for them. We felt it was very important that there wasn't just one single model that everybody had to adhere to, but that there were just certain fundamental principles which were, first and most importantly, that the land was all owned in common, that no individual could own a piece of land within the development. And then that essentially there was a whole series of guidelines that you had to follow in relation to what you built and how you used the land. So that was the basic pattern of it. The village centre, groups of housing, and then on one edge of the site, close to the road that went down one side of it, a small-scale industrial development. We reckoned that a lot of people would be working from home or from workshops in the village centre, but we felt that if it was going to be economically viable in the long run, then some businesses had to grow and start to employ more than just one or two people. And we did some very interesting work looking at the kind of businesses that might be sustainable or possible to maintain in a remote rural area. Obviously, starting from the use of the land itself. And we got in some French agricultural, organic agricultural consultants to do a very, very detailed study of the land. And they produced for us a plan of exactly what could be done with that land. And to satisfy the French government, they did these incredibly detailed financial analyses of how many sheep there were going to be, you know, what the value of the wool, the meat, other byproducts was going to be, how many people it would employ, and then looking at the forestry as a separate industry, and the possibilities for horticulture as well. One of the most fascinating things that came out of that whole study, remember, 850 hectares, 2,000 acres of land, admittedly very low quality land, detailed economic study of how best it could be used. So every bit of land was going to be used in one way or another. How many people do you think that would employ full time? Two. That was the end of their analysis. Two people to farm 850 hectares of land, including the forestry operations. This is just the agriculture. The agriculture and forestry, yeah. One of the interesting add-ons that we discovered as far as agriculture and horticulture was concerned was that right at the north end of the site, remember, as I said, this is a predominantly sheep farming area, and what they mainly use the sheep for is milk. It's the centre of the Roquefort cheese country. I mean, literally within 100 yards of the north end of this 850 hectares of land was the Roquefort factory, which was, you know, a huge factory sitting in the middle of nowhere, churning out tons of Roquefort cheese every year. And of course, cheese making involves a lot of water and produces a lot of effluent, which is very high in biological matter. And what they were doing with the effluent, they basically just drilled a hole down into this porous limestone structure, and they were just emptying it down there. So eventually, I mean, to be fair, you know, limestone is one of the best filtering materials you can possibly get. So, I mean, the water was finding its way into the river at the bottom eventually, but there was no contamination of the river whatsoever. But it was still a horrendous waste of water. They were bringing in water to process the cheese and then just chucking it down a hole in the ground. So what we designed, along with the agricultural consultants, was that just inside the boundary at that north end of the site, which very conveniently slopes downhill from the Rockford factory, we'd have a series of reed bed treatment plants, and then a fairly large horticultural area. So we irrigated all that land with the effluent from the cheese factory. It was obvious very early on that the land itself was not going to provide an income for 1,000 people living there. So we had to start looking at the kind of other things that people might make a living from. And I mean, they're all the usual list of things you find in the eco-village handbooks, and books about communities and so on, all the crafts and the utility, medicine and, you know, running cafes, and teaching, and everything else. But we thought we needed to look ahead a few years and think, what are the kind of industries that might come together in a few years' time? Remember this, well, it was certainly over 10 years ago now. And one of the models we looked at was a business that had spun off from CAT 15, 20 years ago called ABBA Instruments, which in itself, well, it spun off from the renewable energy company. A couple of the engineers there had decided they wanted to develop a particular bit of electronic instrumentation. Only very high-level electronics engineers could possibly dream up something like this. It's apparently for measuring the real-time density of organisms in liquids, which apparently it was impossible to do then. In other words, if you wanted to know the density of organisms in a liquid, you have to take samples and then you have to go away and test them, and that might take 3 or 4 days. And by then, the process had changed and things had moved on. So what they designed was this instrument that you could just put into a liquid and the dial told you exactly what the density of organisms was. They thought this was going to be of tremendous use in the water supply industry, particularly in third world countries, for determining water quality and so on. So they developed it, they marketed it, they got to a point where they set themselves up as an independent business. The irony of it actually is that their main customer now, 15, 20 years on, is the alcohol industry. Because they are one industry that really does want to know. I mean, it's all about yeast. Yeah. They need to know exactly what the proportion of yeast bodies is. And this instrument just did exactly what they wanted. What that sort of thinking about was how that's exactly the kind of business, actually, that could just as well have been located in the depths of rural France, because it was essentially about brain work. All the people employed there were employed thinking and designing things and making instruments, but they only made about three or four of these instruments a year, and they're only this big. So, you know, there weren't environmental impacts to transporting goods here, there and everywhere. It was really straightforward. So we did quite a detailed case study of that, and several other similar businesses that were using mostly brain power rather than materials and could do a lot of their operations on the internet. Now again, you know, the internet boomed since then, so the possibilities now are far, far better than they were when we were thinking about it. But it was just an example of how we were trying to sort of get ourselves out of the rut of traditional eco-village thinking there, which said, okay, everybody's got to be making crafts. If you're going to make a settlement of 1,000 people economically sustainable, then you've got to think a little bit beyond that.
That was former director of the Centre for Alternative Technology in Macunclyth in Wales there, Roger Kelly, talking about plans put together back in the early 1990s with Richard St. George for a giant self-sustaining eco-village. Apologies for the sound, but we're playing this as a tribute to Richard St. George from the Shoemaker Society, who died last year, sadly. And we'll have the final part in coming weeks.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
And I'm joined by Jason Yannakopoulos now. Hi, Jason.
Hi, Tony.
You got a copy of the Daily Mail this week, Jason. Is that your normal newspaper?
Well, as you know, it's definitely not. I normally try not to provide any skin that it can come in contact with.
Oh, is it that bad? I mean, we have our local newspaper here, don't we? Which is actually also owned, the Bristol Post, by the Daily Mail Empire. And I think, you know, this is one of the things that people don't necessarily realise is whoever owns, you know, the newspaper empire or the TV empire, the radio empire, whatever, has a massive, massive influence on what you do and don't hear. What do you think are the sort of characteristics of the Daily Mail on the whole?
Daily Mail, they're scaremongers, really, and personally, I think they're almost like the voice box of the far right in some cases.
Well, they are certainly much associated with the Tory party, although, you know, I think over the years they've got a little bit less racist. They used to be very racist. Of course, they were supporting Adolf Hitler in the run-up to the Second World War in the 1930s, very much so. And in fact, I think I'm right in saying that the owner actually went over to visit Hitler. This is, I think it was Lord Rothermere or someone like that, back in the 1930s. Certainly wrote some very glowing editorials about Adolf Hitler and how he was sorting out Europe. So that was then. Now, not quite so far to the right. But anyway, what story have you dug up out of this paper this week?
It's the average BBC bashing from the Daily Mail.
Well, that's it, isn't it? But the BBC have almost been bashing themselves. I think sometimes when there's one of these stories to do with these big executive payouts, and then one, I think, isn't it Chris Patten, the former Bath MP?
Lord Patten.
Well, I find it difficult to call him Lord Patten, really. I mean, he was a Bath MP, and he was, I think, was the chairman of the Conservative Party. And back in the 1990s, the good people of Bath, even whilst he was a cabinet minister, decided to get rid of him. I mean, he was embarrassed. He was very embarrassed because even though he was in the cabinet, he managed at one of the elections in the early 90s not to be re-elected. And now he's in charge of the BBC. And now it does start to look as if the Tory party are simply placing and the establishment are placing these Tories in charge of the BBC to sort of rubbish it, to have disasters, and so it looks good for the Murdoch empire. And of course Paul Dacre, the editor of the Daily Mail, loves this sort of thing, and so he's gone a big splash with all the troubles at the BBC. But anyway, what are the troubles at the BBC?
Well, this whole thing, it's about using nice pairs of money to pay off, to give large payoffs to sacked BBC bosses, effectively.
And that's how much money, does it say?
It's £369 million. That's for, that's given to all staff over 8 years, and £25 million to 150 senior managers.
Well, that's a lot of money, isn't it? And then this is public money, actually, because it's a state broadcaster. But it's been a bit of a downhill slide for the BBC. One of their presenters, I noticed when poor old David Frost died the other week, and I've been digging around for a really good David Frost quote or interview, Frost.
He is an absolute legend.
Legend. And in the 1960s, David Frost was part of something called That Was the Week That Was.
TW3.
1962 and 1963 that went out. And it was a live satirical programme at the BBC. I don't really think they do anything even vaguely like it. It's almost like they're going backwards, Jason, and having more boring programmes rather than more interesting ones.
It is a shame because, you know, you look at some of the stuff that BBC has produced over the years. You've had That Was the Week That Was, Monty Python, Not 9 o'clock News, Blackadder. I mean, not to say there's not good, still some good programming now, like QI and Doctor Who and Have I Got News For You. But for the BBC, it's just been known throughout its history for producing really good quality programmes. Now we're left with stuff like Strictly, which is...
Well, I mean, this, I think, is possibly linked to the horrible stuff going on at the top executives at the BBC. You know, all these massive payoffs, and it makes you think, well, if the emphasis of the board, and because they have an executive board which actually runs the BBC day to day, and then they've got the BBC Trust which manages the board, that their obsession seems to be around controlling all these senior managers, and in order to control them, they then have to give them massive payoffs and sweeteners and this kind of thing.
Yes, that is a massive shame, and you just have to wonder what would happen if they actually spent some of that on making decent programming.
Yeah, it's no good if they're control freaks, because what you need is creative people, producers, etc., just let off the leash to do what they want. And if they produce something brilliant and award-winning, then maybe you promote them. But a lot of these people who are now in these top positions have actually never really been award-winning people. And they just promoted because they're yes men and yes women. Anyway, less moaning about the BBC, and how about a little bit of David Frost from the good old days? And just to remind us just what the BBC used to be.
This week, your consumer guide presents its report on religions. Of the dozens of products on the market, we investigated the following six: Judaism, the Roman Catholic Church, the Protestant Church, Islam, and communism. We ruled out Hinduism because it embodies a caste system which we felt was alien to the British consumer. However, the Hindu does believe that animals have souls, every bit as good as human ones. In this sense, it could be said that every Englishman is a Hindu at heart. We began by applying three basic tests. A, what you put into it, B, what you get out of it, and C, how much does it cost? Judaism. This is the oldest religion we tested. Its small number of users, 13 million, is deceptive since many large and powerful subsidiaries derive from it. A, what do you put into it? Belief in one only God, several do's and don'ts. Never prepare milk and meat in the same dish. Do no work between sunset on Friday and sunset on Saturday. And you must cut off the foreskins of your male children. B, what do you get out of it? Membership of the oldest club in the world. Prayers and advice are tailored to fit most consumer crises and can also be newly bespoke. You are one of the chosen people. This gives confidence, and we particularly like the guarantee of eternal life through the Messiah, who will take responsibility for all your guilt when he arrives. See, what does it cost? In crockery alone, the expense is fantastic. Plus the wages of a reliable Gentile to run the business between sunset on Friday and sunset on Saturday. Infertility is the only grounds for divorce. We did not try to obtain one. We next tested the Roman Catholic Church. The vigorous new ideas of this splendid corporation were largely pioneered by the previous group. But a sales organization has enabled it to far outstrip the parent company with 340 million current users. Applying the tests, we found A, what do you put into it? Belief in only one Godhead operating on a troika basis. We must stress here that the idea that the head, or pope as he is called, claims infallibility in all matters is a fallacy. The pope cannot tell you which television set is the best. His infallibility is strictly limited to matters of faith. He can only tell you which television programs you mustn't watch. B, what do you get out of it? Principally the new Christianity. The confessional mechanism is standard. The rule here is don't, but if you must, confess as soon as possible afterwards. We found this very useful. A comprehensive life and death advisory service is available from a priesthood unencumbered by family ties. With Roman Catholicism comes a guarantee that it is the only true faith, and exclusive personal survival in heaven is assured. On the whole, we found this product deeply satisfying. What does it cost? A drawback. It is very expensive. During a visit to head office in Rome, a rosary or aid to prayer cost 100 lira. Devotional pictures, 40 lira a time. We were charged 200 lira to see the catacombs. 300 lira to enter the Sistine Chapel, which is very dark. Very dark indeed. And a tour of the anterooms of St. Peter's Basilica cost 300 lira in tips alone. We found it impossible to obtain a divorce. Protestantism. Protestantism is a breakaway from the Roman parent organization. Two main brands are available. The big Church of England or the Nonconformist Economy Pact. What do you put into it? Belief that the Queen should be the head of the church. Belief that the Prime Minister should appoint the Archbishop of Canterbury. And belief in God. What do you get out of it? Independence. How much does it cost? Surprisingly little. We found no difficulty in obtaining a divorce. We next turn to Islam, with 270 million current users, founded 1,300 years ago. It is necessary here to believe in one only God and his true prophet, Muhammad. Begin services with the lesser ablution, wudu, of face, hands and feet. The greater ablution, or ghusl, is being required only after legal pollution, of course. Recite the creed with full understanding once in your life. Go to Mecca once in the life. When you get there, put on two seamless wrappers. Do not shave, trim nails, or anoint the head. Visit the sacred mosque, Masjid al-Haram, of course. Kiss the black stone. Go round the Kaaba three times, then four times. Three times walking, four times running. Seven times in all, of course. Visit the Maqam Ibrahim, climb Mount Safar, run from it to Mount Marwa seven times, go to Muzdalifah, stay the night, throw stones at the three pillars of Mina on the great feast day, offer sacrifice, and if convenient, visit the tomb of Muhammad. What do you get out of it? Up to five wives. How much does it cost? We had to buy a mat, and we found it very exhausting. We didn't need to obtain a divorce. Buddhism. Now, this was the second oldest religion that we tested. It's man-made, flexible, and was designed by Buddha 2,522 years ago. B, what do you get out of it? Nirvana, or a sense of non-being. What does it cost? Nothing. We didn't try to obtain a divorce. We don't understand why communism is on the market at all. It's very recent, mass-produced, and its chief profit appears to have no background in the industry at all. The claim that this shoddy product must inevitably replace all the others in the market we found rather shocking. As in the Church of England, we found no difficulty in obtaining a divorce. In conclusion, we found that as a reward for the good life, all the better religions claim to offer eternal happiness in an everlasting heaven. We decided to test these claims, but were unfortunately unable to find anyone who would undertake this. We apologize for our failure to verify this important aspect of the product. In choosing the Best Buy, we rejected Islam as a cut-price form of Judaism. We liked Buddhism, but the product does not travel well and thrives best in a warm climate. Judaism, we thought, frankly, unsafe. We recommend that unless you have it from birth, you would do well to avoid this product. If you can afford it, Roman Catholicism, with its continental line plus international performance, is well worth having. but we suggest you should think carefully before deciding on it, as it's by no means trouble-free. The attraction of the Church of England lies in its democratic spirit. If you want transubstantiation, you can have transubstantiation. If you don't want transubstantiation, then you don't have to have it. You can just walk down the road into another Church of England church and not have it. If you want Mass, you can have Mass. If you want Immaculate Conception, you can have that too. But nobody will force you to have it if you don't want it. And the church speaks to you in English. Of course, what will happen if we go to the common market? God only knows. But we think it'll still be there, speaking to you in English. And it's a jolly friendly faith. If you are one, there's no onus on you to make anybody else join. In fact, no one need ever know. And it's pretty fair on the whole, too, with some of these products that we've mentioned, Roman Catholicism and Judaism, for instance, you start guilty from the off. But the Church of England is English. On the whole, you start pretty well innocent, and they've got to prove you're guilty. All in all, we think you get a jolly good little faith for a very moderate outlay, and we have no hesitation in proclaiming it the best buy.
Rapturous, live, genuine applause there, Jason. Something we don't really hear on the BBC that much.
The late great David Frost.
He was, and what a star. And of course, there are plenty of people out there, really good comedians and intelligent young people coming out of university, who could do just as good a job as David. I hate to say it, but there's such a pro-establishment line at the BBC nowadays. Before we get totally off the BBC bashing, which I don't like doing because I just want them to be better, you know, I like to bash them into shape. And I'll just say, when I was working there, I saw something coming which really took the morale out of producers and creative people and reporters at the BBC, which was called Producer Choice. Of course, it had nothing whatsoever to do with Producer Choice. It was all about basically going through and accounting for any kind of interaction that happened within the corporation. It was like a big happy family. Then Producer Choice came along, and every time you talked to someone else in the BBC in a different department, you had to fill a form in, basically get the permission of your producer or your manager or whatever. It was so annoying, but it just, you know, it will give listeners a bit of an insight as to, you know, why the BBC has gone so astray. This was all an attempt to make it more like a commercial organisation.
What was the point?
Well, it's easier to control. That's, I'm afraid, the way things go in big corporations. They want to control people. I mean, I much prefer a society where people just kind of do what they want to do. Not everything needs to be run like a Panzer division or an SS troop of SS Panzer Grenadiers. You know, things can happen in a slightly more collective fashion rather than just being told what to do from the top. Anyway, before we get off totally off the subject of the BBC, there's also David Attenborough, been talking this week also about people should be a bit more responsible and only have two children. What are your thoughts on that, Jason?
Well, it is kind of going a bit along the almost fascist sort of line.
Hang on, because the only other country
the other country that does this is a communist country.
That's right, communist. Well, yes, but they're all totalitarian, aren't they? Run by the party. I mean, this is one of the reasons I just can't bring myself to join a political party, is because the party seems to be like, you know, you've got to toe the party line. Actually, the fact of the matter is, a lot of our political parties are very broad, but you know, I just don't like that whole business of, I totally agree with you, you know, about the idea of you should only have two children. It's a little bit too controlling. And also, what it's doing is it's kind of putting the blame on ordinary people, where actually the blame is horrendous leadership and greed by these massive corporations. So shame on you, David Attenborough, for saying people shouldn't have children. It's a bit akin, isn't it, to the stuff we see in the Daily Mail about, you know, people having too many children whilst on benefits.
Well, it's interesting that particular quote is printed in the Daily Mail.
Ah,
yeah, it's funny, isn't it?
How ironic. Anyway, you've got some more stories, haven't you?
We'll start with Syria. You're absolutely going to love this one, Tony. Dave Cameron lost its commentary motion in part by insisting that UN weapons inspectors shouldn't finish their work before an Allied strike. So that is, he was risking his authority trying to preempt an Allied strike.
You know what? It was a total mess, wasn't it? I think what was the front cover of Private Eye this week? Fantastic front cover.
It says Syria, Cameron bombs.
Cameron bombs. Not Cameron bombs Syria, the other way around. Syria bombs Cameron.
Well, it's Syria, Cameron bombs. It's very interesting because it points out that at the start of the Iraq War, US advised UN to pull out its inspectors, leaving their work unfinished. Private Eye suggests that this is partly due to the fact that those pesky inspectors keep contradicting duff claims made by the US and Britain, pointing out that in the Iraq War, nuclear weapons inspectors from the IAEA,
International Atomic Energy Authority,
agency,
oh, right,
showed that the Niger forgeries, which the US claimed were evidence that Saddam Hussein was importing uranium from Africa, were in fact poor quality fakes.
I weren't even good quality fakes. Dear, no. Oh dear.
And that's even after the Americans tried to keep the IAEA from spotting how dodgy some of the documents were. So,
well, I mean, I think one of the fascinating things about the attempt the other week to get the parliament to vote for the Syria war was it was all done on the back of the TV coverage. It was all these films that have been shown on the TV, and it seems to me that's the formula that the powers that be like to have in order to get their wars, is they have a blitz of several days on the TV of horrendous-looking footage, and that seems to be all the evidence that's needed in order to start the next war.
Yeah,
and it doesn't even, you know, necessarily relate to any evidence that's been found on the ground. And of course, the temptation, Jason, for these big arms manufacturers, is to start manufacturing footage, you know, in order to, for the next war. That is to say, to stage things. In other words, that these things could be dramatic stage. One of the things, for example, that there's allegations around the 7/7 London bombing videos, that these guys were recruited to do what are effectively exercise videos. So, you know, you could be brought in and told, right, we're doing an exercise for a bomb attack. Pretend you're a suicide bomber. Yeah? And then you would say, right, oh, I'm going to and do your suicide bomber thing. That film could then later be used. And they would say, oh, look, this is the evidence that he was a suicide bomber. This is the extent to which some people will go to get the wars they want. And that's the particular allegations have been made around the 7/7 London bombings of that, because of the links between some of the bombers and high-level drug dealers, money launderers, and the intelligence services. Anyway, Jason, maybe we're going a little bit too deep down the rabbit hole for that one. What about the next story?
Well, the next story is our good friends, the Frackers.
Oh, not them again.
Yes, I'm afraid it's some more fracking stories for you here. In this case, Dan Biles MP, who is also a lobbyist from Edelman, which is one of the companies involved in this, accused Private Eye of factual inaccuracies by pointing out that they mentioned all the oil companies we raised last week, but they didn't mention the non-paying associate members such as World Wildlife Fund.
Associate members of what?
This is the associate members of the All-Party Group on Unconventional Oil and Gas.
Oh, okay.
But as Private Eye points out, it was interested in whether and who is actually the paying members.
Right. And not the non-paying ones. The ones who are actually funding the lobbying.
It carries on here, following page. Relationship between lobbying firm and Edelman and fracking firms, including Cordrilla, which fund the work of MPs on the All-Party Group of Unconventional Oil and Gas. God, can't they just come up with an acronym for that?
It's great, isn't it?
It's every bit as eyebrow-raising as the arrangement itself. Edelman acts as a secretariat to MPs, and it lists Cordrilla and other frackers such as State Oil of a Arab and UK Onshore Operators Group.
Well, let's just be clear about
fee paying clients for public affairs services.
You just said the key word there. They act as a secretariat. That means to say that they are the people who sit behind the body and actually do the paperwork, print the minutes, all this kind of thing. So they actually control it, don't they? It's like, you know, whoever's your line manager is the lot, the these oil companies that are trying to do the pro-fracking stuff are almost unbelievable, really.
Well, it is unbelievable. Edelman has said that they're not being paid for public affairs services. They are, in fact, being paid in a transactional sense to run the MPs group.
I think I hear the word spin.
Yeah. Quite.
Okay, so more on Atos as well this week. They are this rather nasty little French company, well, big French company, that's been taking away various things like disability benefits, sickness benefits.
Well, actually, I've got some stuff that isn't quite ATOS related but disability related to start with. Cuts to sickness and disability benefits. Controversial enough without Tory ministers misusing statistics repeatedly claim the UK ranks near the top of the international league on spending for disabled people, saying that they spend almost double the Organisation for Economic Coordination and Development, that's the OECD, figures double the OECD average of 1.3%. They claim that only Norway and Iceland spend more, but it's not actually true. The OECD produces two columns, one for disability and one for sickness, and the Department for Work and Pensions have been quoting OECD's disability figure spending, but the sickness column suggests they don't actually spend as much as they've been claiming. And also, far from being double the average spending, OECD statisticians say the UK's total spending on disability-related benefits, adult social care and similar services is actually 2.92% of GDP against the 2.4% that is the OECD average. But that figure includes countries such as Greece and Mexico and Turkey, where disability spending is low. But once it's compared with its neighbours, Belgium, Netherlands, Germany, France, Denmark and Norway, the spending of 2.92% is actually less than the average of 3.29%.
Ah, so it's a complete opposite of what the government's telling us yet again. Quickly, though, because we're running out of time, Jason. Atos.
Yes. Atos, this one is an interesting one because it's once again another example of Atos not catering. And it needs to be, given that they claim that they do not discriminate on the basis of race, religion, colour, sex, age, disability or sexual orientation, they have turned away a man called Charles Foreman, who was turned away from medical assessment centre in Leicester because they felt that his wheelchair was a health and safety risk.
Oh, well, why was that?
It's because they told him that if a fire broke out, the lift would not operate and therefore he would be unable to escape in his wheelchair.
Oh, so no disabled people round here, thank you very much, say Atos. Just finally, Jason, Private Eye itself, I think it may be worth saying something about Private Eye because of the Jimmy Savile scandal. Now, Miles Goslett was the journalist that actually wrote that up. Liz McKean at the BBC had done interviews with some of Savile's victims that Newsnight decided they didn't want to print, but Miles had a chat with Liz and wrote the story up. He went to Private Eye with the story and Private Eye said, no, we're not interested in the biggest story in the year, which makes you wonder. I mean, you know, what are they thinking of? They're very good on a lot of things, but other things, for example, the use of an Israeli security firm during the 7/7 London bombings to run all their CCTV, which then disappeared because there are no CCTV pictures of the four alleged bombers on the trains on 7/7. Private Eye didn't want to touch that story either. So I wonder whether it's a sort of almost like a controlled opposition.
It could well be. As far as the first story goes, Private Eye didn't actually see the tapes or have any transcripts of the interview made by, was it Charles Islett?
Yeah.
So they might have thought that it was a non-story if he didn't have any specific.
But the main thing is that the point being that because Jimmy Savile's dead, you can't be done for libel. Yeah. So they should have run it anyway. That's just my little two labels.
Here's an interesting thing. Another thing they do print, while you mentioned Israel, is our good friend George Galloway, as ever is, he suggested that the chemical weapons that have been accused that Al-Qaeda had were given to them by Israel.
Oh.
I'd like to see his ideas on that.
Interesting suggestion. Okay, more from you next week, I take it, yeah?
Indeed.
Okay, Jason, thanks very much. Now time for the What's On Guide. Jeff?
Thank you, Tony. Hello, this is your What's On Guide from Dialect. Starting on Friday, 13th of September, Cowder Pavonis will be performing with support from Alien Stash Tin at the Stag and Hounds in Old Market, Bristol. Entry is £5 on the door and doors open at 7:30 p.m. Also on 13th of September, Professor Elemental will be performing at the Tunnels in Bristol and Exeter Mews, Bristol. Tickets are £10 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. On to Song of the Week, and I present The Almighty. This group formed in 1988 in Glasgow, Scotland, and in their career have released 7 studio albums, several singles and 2 live albums. This is from the self-titled album, which was released in 2000, and it's a song titled Poison Eyes. With Poison Eyes from the self-titled album, which was released in 2000. Moving into Saturday 14th of September, the Imperials will be performing at the Tunnels in Bristol and Exeter Mews at Bristol. Tickets are £5 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. Finally on 14th of September, Wildflowers, who recently supported Robert Plant, will be performing at Mr. Wolf's with support from Moody Goose at Mr. Wolf's in St. Stephen Street, Bristol. Entry is £3 on the door and doors open at 8 p.m. That's all from me. Thanks for listening and have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
And also, congratulations on your engagement, Jeff.
Thank you very much, Tony.
Yes, keep us informed and invite us to the wedding.
I will do.
Okay.
Thank you.
That's all for this week. Dialects, a weekly podcast for your MP3 player. Produced by volunteers and broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 11 a.m. every Thursday morning. If you're online, you can subscribe to our RSS feed or email list, which will remind you every Tuesday evening when Dialect goes online. You can do that or download this weekly podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. That's dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Roger Kelly for Richard St. George, and that was talking about eco-villages. Also, of course, to Jason Yannakopoulos and studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, do please do so through Volunteering Bristol 0117 989 7733. You'll find them on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Until the same time next week, goodbye for now.
You talk like Marlene Dietrich, and you dance like Zizi Jarmet. Your clothes are all made by Balmain, and there's diamonds and pearls in your hair. Yes, there are. You live in a fancy apartment off the boulevard Saint-Michel, where you keep your Rolling Stones records and a friend of Sacha Distel. Yes, you do. But where do you go to, my lovely, when you're alone in your bed? Tell me the thoughts that surround you. I want to look inside your head. Yes, I do. I've seen all your qualifications you got from the Sorbonne, and the painting you stole from Picasso. Your loveliness goes on and on. Yes, it does. When you go on your summer vacation, you go to Juan-les-Pins with your carefully designed topless swimsuit. You get an even suntan on your back and on your legs. And when the snow falls, you're found in Samoritz with the others of the jet set. And you sip your Napoleon brandy, but you never get your lips wet. No, you don't. But where do you go to, my lovely, when you're alone in your bed? Won't you tell me the thoughts that surround you? I want to look inside your head. Yes, I do. Your name, it is heard in high places. You know the Aga Khan. He sent you a racehorse for Christmas, and you keep it just for fun, for a laugh. They say that when you get married, it'll be to a millionaire, but they don't realize where you came from. And I wonder if they really care or give a damn. Where do you go to, my lovely, when you're alone in your bed? Tell me the thoughts that surround you. I want to look inside your head. Yes, I do. I remember the back streets of Naples, two children begging in the rags, both touched with a burning ambition to shake off their lowly bone tags. So they try. So look into my face, Marie Claire, and remember just who you are. Then go and forget me forever, but I know you still bear the scar deep inside. Yes, you do. I know where you go to, my lovely, when you're alone in your bed. I know the thoughts that surround you. 'cause I can look inside your eyes.